the problem being that Medicare does not currently have power to negotiate drug prices. So she's assuming that that this would be a change in the law that would include that as well. Hey everyone, welcome back to Wonkcast. It's been a long time since we had an episode for you, so I hope you enjoy this one. We've got some brand new co-hosts for you. We've got Fania Jean.
Yes, hello everyone. My name is Fania Jean. I'm currently a first-year student. I'm doing a master's in public administration. I've moved here from Florida, and I'm really excited to be a part of this podcast.
All right. And we have Sean Parker.
Hi, everybody. My name is Sean, and I'm a first-year ENRP student, and I'm excited to be part of the Wonkcast for this year. I'm originally from Vermont, and I'm a background in public communications.
Cool. And I am your returning host, Eli Richman. I'm a third-year MPP.
We have a wide variety.
We have all three programs in Trachtenberg represented.
Yeah. Kudos to us.
All right, so we have a couple things in the news today that we want to bring your attention to. This, as you may know, is our Below the Fold podcast, where we go a little deeper than what you might see in the headlines. We cover details of policy. We go deep into the weeds. And hope you find it interesting. So the first thing Is that okay?
Yeah, okay.
All right. So first of all, Elizabeth Warren has introduced her long-awaited Medicare for All plan. Her status up until this point has been I'm with Bernie, and she didn't have her own plan, whereas like Buttigieg has his own plan and Biden has his own plan and et cetera, et cetera. But now, so now Elizabeth Warren has her own plan. Fania, can you tell me a little bit about it?
Yes. So the goal of Elizabeth Warren's plan, Medicare for All, is to have a program or a universal healthcare program for all 331 million of American citizens that have full healthcare benefits and cover for long-term care. So that's including audio, vision, dental, and mental health coverage. And I think she has really come up with an extensive program, even though majority of people are focused on how is this going to be funded? Where is the money going to be routed? I think she's trying to put out, like, her objective is we are primarily focused on people's health and bringing back that focus on healthcare and working in the interest of all.
Yeah.
I think we're pretty late with implementing these things. We have private insurance, you know, insurance, major insurance corporations, and I think there's a hefty amount of citizens that currently do not have health care.
So in that sense, it's a lot like other Medicare for All plans, you know, where it's a generous insurance plan, single payer, would cover all Americans with, as you said, mental health care. Does it do dental? Do you remember?
Yeah, dental is in there.
Dental and
it has vision too, I believe.
Yes.
Vision.
So audio, vision, dental, mental health, and long term care.
So it's a very comprehensive insurance plan. In fact, it's a lot more generous than a lot of private insurance plans are, and it's certainly more generous than Medicare currently is. And this is true for Bernie's Medicare for All plan also. What Medicare does right now is the Medicare Part A, the part you don't have to pay for, it's a very limited suite of services. If you want a wider suite, you have to pay for it. And that's the private insurance issue right now. Mm-hmm. So.
I think that's also the coverage gap in insurance. So if you actually do get sick, and like, what are we defining sick? Chronic illnesses or illnesses that require not even long-term, but more extensive medical care, those aren't really covered by insurance companies, I think. again, very limited.
Yeah. Yeah, it certainly depends. So I think what a lot of journalists specifically have been focusing on with Warren's Medicare for All plan are the pay-fors. Everyone seems focused on the pay-fors, with much of the aggravation of some of my progressive friends who say, like, why didn't we talk about pay-fors when we were doing Trump's tax cut? Which I think is fair, but it's also worth noting that these are expensive programs. I think Bernie's is quoted at $32 trillion, over 10 years.
Yeah, I think what, Elizabeth Warren has, I think, almost created more of a story for herself with this Medicare for All is with the payment of it, just based off of what, you know, I've seen through during the debates up until now. She's had a hard time addressing the issue of how to pay for it, and I don't know if you guys have all seen it, but
yeah,
she has kind of a very canned approach to when she gets asked,
right,
about, well, how are you going to actually pay for this program? She
kind yeah.
There's a broad overview of, well, it's not going to be affect middle class people, but she won't get down to like the actual brass tacks.
Yeah.
I think because she didn't address this early on, like Bernie Sanders did with his Medicare for All plan, it's almost become this balloon sized story because of that.
It's interesting though, because I think not talking about it is also part of her political calculus. I mean, a lot of what we've been getting is, she wants to say, look, yeah, taxes are going to go up, premiums are going to go down, so what you pay is going to be different. But if she says that, like, literally, then Republicans are going to cut the sound bite of her saying, yes, taxes are going to go up, out, and play it in ads for it.
Yeah.
And so that's what she doesn't want to do. And so...
But now, since she's released extensive detail of what all of her plans entail, so the overview is basically rerouting the money into our current system, rerouting the money that's used in our current system to implement the new system. And basically, with the release of the details of this plan, it's rerouting the money that's used in our current system to implement and maintain the new system. So she put on, I guess she said, in the last 10 years, we've used over $52 trillion for healthcare. And she said with the new plan, our new plan being implemented, we'll use just under $52 trillion over the next 10 years. So it basically makes up of, The idea is to make up for the differences of expenses by making targeted spending cuts, new taxes on giant corporations and the richest 1%, and cracking down on tax evasion and fraud, and leaving the middle class out of it. So no increases of taxes on the middle class.
Right. So I think the big, what's underlined for me here in this list of pay-fors is the rerouting of what employers pay. So, you know, that's a huge part of our current healthcare system. I mean, so if we look at, like, who currently pays for healthcare, it's mostly employers, a little bit the employees, a sort of the American government, and then the rest on out-of-pocket expenses from, I think, public policy advocates for a long time struggled with, like, how do you capture the employer piece of that? Because it's long established in the U.S. that we have employer-provided health insurance, and employers are used to paying a lot per employee for that health insurance. And what Warren, I think, is saying here is we're going to make you, the companies, roughly even by taking those costs away, but increasing your payroll taxes to basically the same.
I mean, reading her plan that's on her site, she's basically saying the money from employers should be rerouted into the government to, I guess, fund or implement this plan and continue sustaining it. So, yes, the money is going to be given to the government and paying off these different, I guess, medical expenses. So it's kind of, we are literally rerouting how the finances are going to pay for all these medical expenses. So yes, it's taking off that most of, I guess, the responsibility on workers or employees and just shifting that all into the government, and they're going to be more responsible for relaying that money to sustaining this program.
Yeah, I think it's essentially just a transfer of like where the money comes from. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's also an argument to be made that I think employers would also benefit and also be more inclined to this new system just because cost-wise, I think it's going to help them if they don't have to worry about providing health insurance for their employees. It's one less thing that they have to take care of. And obviously, that's going to be made up on the back end somewhere, but
on payroll taxes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that would be more evenly dispersed and then hopefully being able to bring down overall costs.
Yeah. Based on her plan, or at least the details that are listed on her site about the plan, she does say that the prices should decrease over time for employers.
Yeah.
With all other things implemented.
I think, and I had it written down that she said that originally they'll pay 90% of the pay employee health care costs in payroll taxes, a pretty specific amount.
Yeah.
Warren also has tried to cut down the cost of this program by assuming a lot of things.
Yes.
So, yeah, I think we should. For instance, one of the big savings that she incorporates is a reduction in drug prices, which will theoretically come from Medicare being able to negotiate drug prices, now having this big pool of patients it's covering. The problem being that Medicare does not currently have power to negotiate drug prices. So she's assuming that that this would be a change in the law that would include that as well.
I think that assumption is coming from another assumption of restoring, I guess, the healthcare competition. So if you're bringing down the prices of healthcare costs and then trying, I guess, evening out the playing field for all of these healthcare providers, and then hopefully in turn that will bring down the prices as well instead of like, so people have more options. It's more equal and all that stuff, and we're not fighting for different, I guess, brands are paying for the actual product instead of, like, who's providing it. Does that make sense?
This is just a general question. We can put this out if you want, but I'm assuming that if, like, say there is a new Warren administration, that she will be in position to actually implement policy that allows them to negotiate prices with the insurance and the prescription.
Sean, I'm so glad you brought this up, because this is really where I wanted to go with the discussion. This is my pet peeve in the whole Medicare for All discussion. We have these debates, and it's my plan this, my plan that. My plan costs less than yours. Your plan doesn't cover everybody, blah, blah, blah. There seems to be very little recognition that laws are written by Congress. And it's not like, you know, Elizabeth Warren can have this detailed plan, but she's going to hand it over to Congress and they're going to massively edit it. So this whole concept of, like, criticizing each other's plans, like, it just seems like a lot of hot air to me. Especially because I think what most Americans, if I may be so bold as to say what most Americans want, they just want to see government do something.
Mm-hmm.
So I am fairly confident that if Congress passed a Medicare for All bill and Joe Biden were president, he would sign it. And also, Bernie Sanders were president and Congress passed a bill that just like strengthened Obamacare and created like public option.
Public options.
Yeah. He would sign that.
Yeah.
Like, so the differences are, I mean, it's good to have ideas about how to expand healthcare, and I guess you could talk about primaries being like a debate of ideas, but to the extent that it actually affects presidency,
yeah.
Yeah, I guess this gets to just like how complicated this whole process is, because healthcare on itself is already extremely complicated, but then there's the whole political side to things. What is actually feasible? What can actually be done? And I think you're correct that, you know, a lot of ifs have to happen in order for any of this to take place. You know, it's not going to really matter if a Biden or a Warren presidency takes place and they don't control the Senate, or let's say they lose the House or something. None of this is going to be able to go through. But I do think that it's important, though, for each of one of these candidates with their Medicare plans, you know, to aim high and get their ideas out there, because of what you just said, you know, there's going to be a lot of sausage making, for lack of a better term. And so by the time you actually get to a final result, it's not going to look anything like, you know, what they threw the stick on the wall.
Yeah. And I think that's why she was so hesitant or reserved in all of her explanations when people are actually asking, how are you going to do this? How is the money actually going to be rerouted to this or that? I think it's, we really don't know the future. You don't know what's going to be crossed out. Yeah. You don't know how Congress is going to edit or what's actually going to be passed by the people or the people that represent us. So I think it all plays a part. We don't know the future, but we do know there's a lot of people behind this program.
Absolutely.
All right. So thanks, Vanya. That was really interesting. I've been a little bit like weary of this whole, you know, Medicare for all, pay for conversation. So it's good to delve into the details a little bit. The next thing we want to talk to you about today is the Paris Accords. So the Trump administration has officially moved to pull out of the Paris Accords. And Sean, I was hoping you could tell me what that means, because I thought this happened 2 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is a great question. I think that's one that is still open to interpretation, because I think both home and abroad, people are trying to figure out what exactly that means. But like you said, on November 4th, President Trump announced officially that the United States was going to be withdrawing from the Paris Accord. And basically what that means is that this is going to be the starting process now where the U.S. actually starts to withdraw from any obligations or commitments that it's made for the Paris Accord. And so the issue of the Paris Accord basically covers all major countries, large and small, that have made a commitment to collaboratively try to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. And in particular in the United States, this whole process started actually long, I think before 2015, but in 2015, the then administration under President Obama was able to put together this coalition where the U.S. was leading, where it was promising to cut emissions about 28% to our 2005 pollution levels. And there's a lot of heavy science that goes into this, but essentially the goal is to have all the major industrial economies plus the economies of the developing world start to take seriously about what kind of implications our economies have on the climate.
The thing about Paris, right, is that they don't actually set any targets. Like, it's all voluntary.
Right. Yeah. So this is where the accord gets a little bit wishy-washy, is that it's not like it's more of a voluntary agreement. It's not binding, which is why the U.S. was actually able to pull out essentially as easy as it is.
But I think that's with all accords and all agreements. They come up with these goals or objectives that sound beautiful to all countries. And yes, we would want to join, but then actually implementing it in their country or whichever government or body, it's a lot harder, and you're not going to be able to make those goals or actually commit to those objectives. So I think it's up to everybody, and no one, yeah, will plan and all that stuff, but for actually making the goals and binding another country to it, everyone could throw their hat out or whatever. What's the saying? Throw their hat in the bin.
Throw your hat in the ring.
In the ring. Is that?
Yeah, throw your hat in the ring. Yeah.
Whenever they feel like it.
Yeah. And so, this is exactly why having the U.S. presence in things like this is vitally important, because normally when the U.S. makes a commitment, it initiates other people to tag along, because people are used to relying on the U.S. as being someone that will stick to their word. And of course, with like recent administration changes, this, one of the main problems that this pullout of the Paris Accord leaves is who is going to take the leadership role now. And this is kind of where we're at with, in terms of like the global community, is, you know, the European Union, a lot of the major countries in there, like Germany and France, are kind of taking turns trying to figure out what to do next, because they just don't have that authoritative body to kind of lead by example. And interestingly, China has a really significant role in this now, because they are actually the world's largest polluters as of now, and actually surpassed the U.S. several years ago as the world's largest polluter. But they also have a lot of heavy influence. And so now that the U.S. has pulled itself away as being the person in charge of running this initiative, now there's a lot of speculation and expectation that China is going to be filling that void where the U.S. left off.
That's ironic.
That's really interesting. Mm-hmm. And that can, I can imagine that having wide-ranging implications. Just to circle back to the U.S. for a second, just in terms of what, here's what I want to know, Sean, is when Trump took office, let's back up even further. So the Paris Accords, it's about accountability. Each country just says, like, here's how much emissions we think we're producing this year. And just making that information public. And if they have any targets that they want to hit, like, we're going to try to hit this target this year. When Trump took office, the U.S.'s representation in the Paris Accords started saying, they just started submitting one line every update, which was, the U.S. does not have any goals. Like, we're not doing anything. Which is allowed by Paris, because it's totally voluntary. So, when Trump in his first year of office said we're pulling out, he's essentially saying we're not even going to do that. We're not even going to say we're doing nothing. That seems like a really easy change to me. So why did that take 2 years?
Hold on. I want to, I guess, ask again. So you were saying that when the U.S. was committing to the Paris Accords or setting it up, that they said that they were not going to, that they were not going to commit to any reductions?
Once Trump took office.
Right.
I think during the Obama administration and once they entered Paris, the language the U.S. was giving was like, we're currently producing this many regulations and this is what we're aiming for through X programs. I don't actually know the exact language on that, so take what I'm saying with a heavy dose of salt. But I do know that once that changed, once Trump went into office, and they just started submitting letters with literally two lines that are like, the U.S. does not feel like it has any obligations at the moment.
Right. Well, and I think this is the kind of conundrum or big question that we all have is, you know, what was the benefit of us pulling out of the accord under the Trump administration?
Sorry, before we get into it, do we know, or can I ask you, what was the main motivation for us, like, just pulling out completely? Like, what finally, or what do you think influenced this decision?
It's just Trump's hatred of Obama, right? Like, he just wants to reverse everything Obama did. That's all. That's the only thing I can make there, because, like, they weren't doing anything anyway. Paris are completely voluntary.
They were doing things, but yeah, it wasn't like, there was no punishment for not doing it, but there was actual levels that they were trying to meet, you know, without looking at the specifics. You know, there was a threshold that they were trying to reduce before 2030, which ironically, even if they hit that, it was still above the threshold that we needed to be at, but it was still less than current levels right now.
And I think just being a part of the accord, it kind of gave some momentum to organizations that their main vision or main goal is to protect the environment,
bring down levels or pollution levels. Mm-hmm. So I think that, I don't know where exactly I heard this, but there have been some slight pullbacks with, like, you know, funding for these organizations, because again, it's not a main priority of the United States.
Yeah, totally. Just kind of go back to, like, what would be the reason why Trump would want to do that, aside from, like, you were saying, I think it just, I guess this is kind of the same thing you do, but it just goes to his America First policy, which I think is, you know, anything outside of our actual jurisdiction or boundary is not our problem. And, so we'll see what, I mean, we already are seeing the implications of this. Yeah, I think the effects are going to be profound and complicate the problem even more.
So with all of these, I guess with this new announcement that came out, and everyone, I guess the public, the people who have been, you know, rallying against climate change and, like, we have to do something, what is, like, the main response to this announcement?
Well, I think it's still kind of evolving, but interestingly, there's a lot of businesses in states and municipalities that immediately after Trump announced originally that we were going to pull out, decided to coordinate and actually sign a pledge that they were going to commit themselves, whether it was like a city or like the state of California, and I believe Oregon and Washington are all part of the Paris Accord still, even despite the U.S. entirety is pulled out.
I think I do remember that, like, California joined individually.
Actually, Michael Bloomberg, he was actually responsible for setting up this coalition that, like, got a bunch of cities and organizations to pledge, even though Trump has, you know, officially announced that we're not going to do that anymore. So I think there's momentum there that I'm sure over the next couple days or even weeks, we'll probably hear more about. And I think if anything, that this is going to probably set up the, you know, the Democratic presidential candidates to speak more on this issue, because I also think that that is something that hasn't really gotten the light of day that it deserves in primaries so far.
Environmental issues kind of get neglected, yeah, for being honest.
And I feel like when things like this in particular, when Trump makes, like, the official announcement, presents a great opportunity for them to kind of remind people, like, hey, no, this is not what we want to do. And
definitely.
Yeah. I think there's kind of a cottage industry about making fun of presidential debates for not including questions about climate change. it's pretty ridiculous. I think in the 2016 cycle, there was literally not one during the general election debates.
Yeah. And then I guess one other thing, too, that I find really interesting about the official pullout of the Paris Climate Accord is that, you know, when Trump first took office and he talked about, or when he announced, I think in the spring of 2017, that we were going to no longer be a part of that, but we hadn't officially pulled out yet, there was a lot of fear that there was going to be a lot of other countries deciding to do the same, just because if they saw that the U.S. was going to do it, then why would we stay as well, you know? Mm-hmm. Especially countries that are just ramping up their economies right now. And instead, we've actually seen an increase of people that have joined the Paris Accord, although there wasn't that many more anyways. Virtually almost every country had signed up for it. So that's encouraging. But the downside, like you were saying, Eli, is, you know, it's more of like a general agreement to address this, but there's a lot of gaps within the accord that need to be addressed to actually make reductions or get to that level where we can start doing that.
It sounds pretty, but the action behind it is just not.
I mean, I actually think the accountability is a great way to reduce. Just having, you know, people have to produce regular reports about how much they're emitting. I mean, it's sort of like this public shaming in a way. If you're emitting a lot, and, you know, we don't have to do environmental reports on it every time, and, you know, it's just regular coming out. We just have that data. The thing I still understand is, like, so Trump said we're signing the official agreements to withdraw from Paris, right? He said that
November 4th.
November 4th. But it seems like varying degrees of doing nothing. Like, you know, first we were in the Paris Accords and we weren't really, we were just like kind of...
A huge supporter.
Yeah, we were not, and then Trump took over and we didn't have any spirit. There was no spirit in the Accords anymore. We were just like in it nominally. And then Trump announced that we're not going to be in Paris anymore, so we're not even going to be it nominally. So what's the difference between that and now?
I think it's the spirit of being able to influence other countries, because now it's like, that public shaming can only go so far. I'm not going to be ashamed as much anymore, because the United States, they're not even a part of this agreement. You know, I think that accountability is what we're really, what we really needed from the United States, just being a member of the agreement, although they weren't actually acting on it.
Yeah.
I think it's more so the spirit and actually trying to work towards something instead of flat out saying we're doing nothing.
Yeah, it's the perception that you're presenting to the world. And I think specifically, like with the U.S., you know, when we say that we're not going to abide by, you know, the standards that we set for ourselves, really just means that we are just going to not enforce ourselves to do it. So, you know, we said that we were going to cut emissions to by 28% to the 2005 levels. But now that Trump says that we're not going to do that, that basically just means business as usual. We're going to ramp back up coal production, more natural gas, more offshore drilling, you know, all the traditional forms of like where we generate a lot of our emissions from is kind of just got a green light right now. So I think it's more of, it actually affects us personally a lot more than we think about it in terms of like the Paris Accord, because it's such a global commitment from everyone, but it's really kind of like self-inflicting.
Yeah.
I also have like another question. Do you believe, again, us pulling out of this accord, do you think it adds to the new business model that we're taking towards government? Or is it more so just we're trying to undo previous administrations?
That's a good question.
I have a thought on that. I mean, I think officially, you know, making the move to officially withdraw 2 years after saying you're going to withdraw, it's catty. Like, it's, you know, it's re-entering a party so that you can slam the door and leave again. But what it does mean is that we can't easily just say, no, we're not doing that anymore. Like, if a Democrat wins the presidency in 2020 and Trump had not taken a step, even though he had said we were going to take the step, then the administration could just reverse course.
Mm-hmm.
But if we actually withdraw, then we do need to, then a future administration actually has to go through a procedure to re-enter the Paris Accord if they want to do that.
Yeah, and that's correct. Yeah, and ironically, the official pullout, like, where we'd no longer be involved at all, is the day after the next presidential inauguration. So, January 21st, or whenever that is. So, it puts a little bit more of an incentive on both sides to kind of sell the climate Paris Accord as either good or bad business for us.
I feel that the Paris Accord, it's going to be great for economies if we're not, you know, we're promoting businesses to conduct business as normal. You don't have to cut back on things. You don't have to worry about, I guess, the nuances of making sure your reports on your emission status is out. But I guess that takes away, yes, it's great for business. The thing that takes away from, like, actually caring about your consumers and their actual health and things. I don't know if we talked about the direct effects to the consumer itself, like us as individuals and not just as a country, and how we're influencing other countries. How are we considering people as just people, as individuals?
Mm-hmm.
Is it like, do we not? It's just, are we like just moving people's health to the side? It's like, oh, it's okay, because economies can continue to flourish if we continue to produce.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, and that it raises, you know, that this issue kind of touches everything, right? You know, mm-hmm. it affects people on the individual level, it affects businesses, and
affects whole economies. So I guess it really kind of depends on where the value system lies and what are we willing to do and sacrifice in order to ensure that, you know, down the road, you know, future generations can still thrive. So, I mean, it might be more expensive in the short term, but, you know, could pay big dividends in the long term.
All right. Well, Sean, thanks for sharing all that. And thank you, listeners, for sticking with us, through our long, sabbatical off producing episodes. I promise they'll be coming more regular now. And you can find us, if you haven't already subscribed, on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, wherever else you get your podcasts.
Not wherever else. There's a bunch of different apps now. Can't even say that.
Can't say that?
Nope.
Wow.
There are a lot of different platforms.
I know it's at least on those four. Google Play, Spotify, iTunes, and Stitcher. So go to one of those and you can find and you can find our feed there. I hope you'll come back and join us.
Thanks for tuning in.
Thanks.